This is day 5 of this January 2016 Rohatsu 7-day session. I'm going to read and comment on some teachings of Zen Master Hakuin's disciple, maybe Dharma heir, I'm not sure, Toray, Zen Master Toray. And this is the first time I've ever done this. It's a fairly new book I'll be reading from. Well, 2010. But the book is called The Undying Lamp of Zen. And the subtitle is The Testament of Zen Master Toray. This is translated by Thomas Cleary. Start with some biographical material about Toray. I'll be reading now from a book called Zen Dust by Miura and Sasaki. This was the source of biographical material on the master's until Andy Ferguson came out with his Zen's Chinese Heritage, which is just the Chinese masters. This is Toray is Japanese, as, of course, Hakuin. So there's not a lot. We're told here that, his dates are 1721 to 1792. So he spanned the early days of our own republic. The War of Independence here. His mother came from a Shinto family of some importance. Shinto is sort of the nativistic religion, I guess you could call it, of Japan. It's still the predominant religion in Japan, way more than Buddhism. The custom in Japan is you get married in a Shinto wedding and your funeral is Buddhist. His mother came from a Shinto family of some importance, and throughout his life, Toray continued to have close connections with Shinto and Shinto thought. When he was 9, he was taken to a local temple to become a monk. And when he was 17, he went to a certain other temple. And there, 3 years later, he took the precepts from a Rinzai monk. And then in 1743, he would have been 32 then, he was on a visit to his home village and he heard of the great Hakuin. And he immediately went to the village of Hara, and where Hakuin's temple was located. It would be Hara, wouldn't it? Hakuin's home temple. He hadn't been with Hakuin for very long when the illness of his mother called him back to his home village and kept him there for nearly 2 years. And then in 1746, he set out for Kyoto. He seems to have had at least a first Satori experience while with Hakuin, and then he wanted to devote himself to a period of after Satori practice. This was established way to go after your enlightenment. Then you would sometimes withdraw for even decades, some of these great masters, withdraw to the mountains and ground your enlightenment in daily zazen for long periods of time to kind of season it. It says, in a retreat he found for himself, he subjected himself to severe and solitary meditation practice for 150 days. And this period culminated in a profound experience, and he wrote about this at once to Hakuin. But then Tori was forced to remain in Kyoto because as a result of this punishing 150-day retreat, he had developed tuberculosis. And it says here he suffered from this more or less continuously throughout the remainder of his life. This was took quite a toll on the Japanese of old times. Dogen was supposed to have died of tuberculosis. There's this big shame, some kind of shame about having TB in Japan, and or there used to be, maybe still, and it's almost never referred to it as such in the old texts. A little surprised here that it's named tuberculosis here. It says his enforced idleness in Kyoto during the early part of the illness gave him an opportunity to read and study a number of Zen texts, and it is this at this time that he laid the foundations for his later career as a Zen scholar. And it was during this stay in Kyoto that Tori wrote one of his most notable books, and that's the one we're going to be reading from, The Undying Lamp of Zen. He completed it in 1748 and immediately sent it to Hakuin. The following year, he received a letter from... The following year, imagine. No email in those days. The following year, he received a letter from Hakuin expressing admiration for the work. And shortly after this, his health improved quite a bit, and he was able to leave Kyoto and return to his temple. Hakuin then made him one of his heirs and presented him with his own robe. Tori was now invited to become the abbot of several different temples, but he consistently refused, preferring to devote himself to writing and lecturing on Zen texts. Period. We're told also that Hakuin seems to have been particularly attached to Tori, and during the latter part of his life, he bought Tori an old temple on the lower slopes of Mount Fuji, not far from Hara. Not much more. After Hakuin's death in 1769, Tori devoted himself to rebuilding a temple that his master had founded. And Tori, like Hakuin, was a famous calligrapher and an excellent painter. Finally, in 1791, Tori retired to a small temple in his native village, where he passed away a few months later. From time to time, I hear people who say that they can't imagine a Zen master retiring, but we see this in the old accounts whether he did so when he had become too infirm to continue teaching, don't know. Well, that's our material on Torre, Semester Torre. And now we're going to turn to the book he wrote, The Undying Lamp of Zen. I'm going to start with, in the preface of this book, he gives us some of his own, his autobiographical material, just a little bit, maybe a little bit of what we read and what led up to his writing of this book. He just starts here in the preface referring to his, he says, my perception. So let's just read it as translated here. After my perception was fully developed, I had not yet mastered the ancients' subtleties of differentiation, so I stayed in seclusion for more than 100 days of intense cultivation. I had not yet mastered the ancient subtleties of differentiation. So, awakening reveals the indivisibility of all things, and the formlessness of so many, all the forms of this phenomenal world. In other words, it reveals the unity or the undifferentiated nature of reality, that which is behind this world of differentiation. But then after this experience, there is the job of coming to balance that what can be very powerful experience of oneness or emptiness with integrating that into the world of differentiation, of all of the conventional world and the world of differences, integrating the world of sameness into the world of differences. So I had not yet mastered that, so I stayed in seclusion for more than 100 days of intense cultivation. He just rounded it off. 150, he made it more than 100. A sense of shame, this is very telling, a sense of shame and determination penetrated my bones and marrow. Though I'd attained my aim, because I hadn't taken care of my physical health, and had overexerted my mind, my internal organs were all stressed, resulting in serious illness. We read about this so, with so many of the great masters pushing themselves to the point where their health breaks down. The ones we read about, it does result in a great realization. And I bet you they would not trade that realization for good health. Subsequently, though I relaxed to take care of this, it was by no means easy to cure. I was subjected to mischief from outside, or troubled by worldly relations. I can only wonder what that is. And suffered the sick bed three times. Once I'd get well, I'd fall sick again. This went on for 3 years. The doctors gave up on me, telling me that even if I recovered from this illness for the time being, I couldn't have more than 3 or 4 years left to live. Well, it turns out that he lived much longer. At this point, I reflected that my life was not worth regretting. That's an interesting way of putting it. It was not worth regretting. I only lamented the fact that I had not yet fulfilled my original vow to help myself and help others, and had gone through all this hardship in vain. It's hard to understand why he would say this after an awakening, a real enlightenment experience. Clearly, a man of great sense of responsibility to others, responsibility to uphold the teaching and convey the teaching to others. Finally, I emulated Master Sung Zhao, who wrote a treatise as he was awaiting execution and hurriedly set forth this exposition. This meaning his own, Torrey's own book that we're reading from. And I hurriedly set forth this exposition. This master, Sung Zhao, was famous for his death verse. He ran afoul of the imperial government in 4th century China, and as he was about to be led out to be executed, he said these very stirring words that reveal his own deep realization of the selflessness of all beings. He said, "The four elements essentially have no master. The five shadows," those are the skandhas, "the five shadows are fundamentally empty. The naked sword will sever my head as though cutting the spring breeze." And now, back to our text. Torrey is describing what led up to the writing of this book. He said, "Sitting on a cushion day and night with writing materials by my side, I wrote down what came to me, completing a manuscript in only 30 days. I call it Discourse on the Undying Lamp of Zen. This is based on the sense of one lamp imparting its flame to hundreds and thousands of lamps in an undying succession of lights." Of course, he's talking about this mind-to-mind transmission that Zen is famous for. "30 days," he wrote this. "After this, I sat and reclined at ease, leaving my life to fate. And I felt the illness getting lighter and lighter day by day. After another half year, I knew in myself that I could survive." This also is not that rare to read of on the verge of death, either coming to enlightenment then and recovering, or in this case, having already done so, but recently. "For this reason, I reconsidered. Had my illness been terminal, and had I presented this treatise to my old teacher, Hakuin, I would have asked that he make any useful points of enduring encouragement for later people, and if it had nothing useful in it, I'd consign it to the fire. Now that I had been able to get over this illness, with the living person present, what would be the use of dead complications? At this point, I was going to burn my treatise, but before I had done so, my old teacher personally sent me a letter, and I went back to see him. As we spoke in private, I mentioned this treatise and eventually read it to the old teacher. He said it could be a help to younger students." Look at the modesty. "Younger students. And firmly forbade me to burn it. This being so, I nevertheless kept it stored away for a long time. Now, due to the urgent request of believers, I cannot but permit it to be copied." However, writings and sayings are a basis of liberation and the base of bondage too. If given to the wrong person or at the wrong time, even ghee turns to poison. It's a clarified butter that's very popular in Tibet. Even ghee turns to poison. I beg you to reflect deeply upon this and not let this treatise be read by the wrong people or at the wrong time. If you violate this strict rule, you are no comrade of mine, ever. Especially since I've been sick a lot and unable to edit and correct the manuscript, how could this text be considered definitive? It will only be suitable as a definitive text after I've had a chance to recheck it sometime. Well, did he ever recheck it? Doesn't say. And so this, he signed Tore NG in 1751. There isn't a lot that I found in this book that's suitable for reading in Taisho. It's pretty dense in places. A lot of reference to doctrine and doesn't flow particularly well as an oral reading. We can cut him some slack since he did it in 30 days on the verge of death. But I'll just pick out a few things here. If you are genuine practitioners, get to know the strictures and difficulties of the road, the passes and the obstacles, and only then set out. Entering in directly, let go of your pre-existing fixations and minimize your entanglements. Make your footsteps light and your sense of the way heavy. Let's go back over this sentence. Entering in directly, let go of your pre-existing fixations. This is the hardest thing in the world because the worst of our hindrances we're not aware of. We have certain views and ideas about things, reality, people, that we just assume are the way things are, the way they are. But these are the very things that block our discovery of the way things really are. So we rely on practice as a way to sooner or later expose these things that are false, these filters that have been over our eyes our whole life. Every step of the way on this path, we discover that what we had thought was the way things are is not. It's different. Let go of your pre-existing fixations and minimize your entanglements. Minimize your entanglements. When people ask sometimes how they should prepare for a sesshin, upcoming sesshin, usually what I say is just try to find a way to simplify your daily life. Cut out some unnecessary things, especially exposure to media. Let go. Minimize your entanglements. Make your footsteps light and your sense of the way heavy. It's an unusual way of phrasing this. Your sense of the way heavy. I would take that to mean take seriously this opportunity that you have. This having encountered the Dharma. Don't take it lightly. On the other hand, what we find through long practice is we do acquire a greater sense of lightness when we stop taking ourself so seriously. That is, when we start to see the unreality of any kind of permanent self, then we naturally lighten up. Nothing heavier and more unnecessary than the drama that swirls around the self, self and other, this false sense, selfhood. Don't seek fame and gain. Don't mix in worldly thoughts. These are big things that he's ticking off in a phrase or a sentence. Don't mix in worldly thoughts. What an impact that would have on our sitting to not mix in worldly thoughts, such as fame and gain, success and failure. Your heart will become joyful, as if you were setting out on the road back home, like you were going into a mine of gold and jade, like you have become an emperor. Keep on this way, thought to thought, and you can congeal a mass of wonder. Now, wonder here, he means the doubt sensation, questioning. And wonder is probably the best word for it, wondering. And then he offers examples. Right now, what is this? What is it that sees? What is it that hears? What is it that moves? What is it that sits? At all times, in all places, focus on your mind and see how it is. Without conceiving of being or non-being, without thinking of affirmation or negation, without discriminating, without rationalizing, just observe in this way. Look. When the time comes, it will appear of itself, without need of your intellectual discrimination. As soon as you conceive discrimination, you obscure original essential nature. Then even if you labored forever, you couldn't get it. Discrimination. Here too, as with what he said earlier about giving up your fixations, with discrimination, so often we don't realize we're involved in discrimination. We don't see it. It's going on all the time and we don't realize it. And that's where the practice comes in, to turn the mind away from this work of discrimination and bring it back to the underlying unity behind all discrimination. The great Taoist sage said, Lao Tzu said, behind the divisible there is always something indivisible. behind the disputable, there's always something indisputable. That is what our practice takes us to, through the thicket of discrimination, to this great plain, this ocean of unifying mind. As soon as you conceive discrimination, you obscure original essential nature. One way to maybe have a chance of spotting the discrimination when it's happening is if you notice that there's some kind of a choice in your mind, any division, any two-ness. So I remember from when I was working on Mu, should I work on it this way or should I work on it that way? One way more kind of a tunnel vision where you're boring into the Mu and you kind of lose awareness of what's around you? Or should it be more of an opening, a broadening awareness of Mu? Right there, that's discrimination. Just Mu. There may be times when the boring into it, that single-minded focus, is called for, when it more naturally arises that way. There's an old Chinese saying, Zen saying, one who is working on Mu does not see the sky when she raises her head, nor the ground when she lowers it. That's a certain way of working on it, and it can lead to a breakthrough. But we don't want to be bound to that style of working on it. If it seems that things are opening up, you're aware of sounds and other sense experiences, as long as you keep the mind on Mu, that's all right too. The main thing is to let Mu consume you. And then he himself moves into discussion of Mu. If thoughts are flying around, consider this story. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Mu. Bring it to mind directly. And don't interpret it logically. Don't interpret it as flavorless. Don't interpret it as nothing. If you conceive any logical understanding, you'll never complete the work. But don't develop an illogical mind either. Logic and no logic are, after all, random ideas. Just bring it up and look at it. It has nothing to do with interpretation. It is the real way of practice of the Buddhas. Continue moment to moment, whether speaking or silent, active or quiet, walking, standing, sitting, lying down. Do not forget it. Or if you occasionally forget, don't lose power. Don't lose power. Maybe we could understand that as don't let yourself be distracted by other things. Even if you do forget it, we can't control our forgetting it. Sometimes we just discover that we've forgotten it. But at least don't knowingly scatter the mind. Maybe that's what he means by don't lose power. Because that's how we do lose power. And we acquire power by keeping the mind focused on Mu, on the question, who am I? What is it? On the breath. at Shikantaza. This is like learning archery. It takes a long, long time to hit the bullseye. Just develop the will to persevere. Be careful not to flag and slack. If you give up this teaching, by what teaching can you attain liberation? And if you are not liberated, you cannot escape vicious cycles. And how do the pains and troubles of vicious circles compare to the toils and pains of Zen practice? And by vicious cycles and vicious circles, I'm talking, of course, about what his teacher referred to as from dark path to dark path, I've wandered in darkness, circling through the six worlds. How does the fun of false thinking compare to the delight of seeing essential nature? Even the temporal glory of a human king is still considered noble, how much more a king of the supreme Dharma? Once you've developed a great heart and do not regress moment to moment, the achievement becomes perceptible. Those who detach from birth and death but do not clarify the way are like birds who want to fly without wings, like trees that want to flourish without roots. Please think about this. Then he quotes the great Da Wei, Zen Master Da Wei, one of his and Hakuin's predecessors in Rinzai Zen. If you do not retreat from your initial inspiration moment to, if you do not retreat from your initial inspiration moment to moment, taking your consciousness from its focus on worldly troubles and returning it to insight, then even if you do not break through in this lifetime, still, when you're facing death, you won't be dragged down by bad habits into bad states. In the next life, you'll surely be able to actually experience insight according to the power of your vows in this life. This is a certain fact, not to be doubted. How much more Tore continues, how much more if your investigation is unremitting, the great Dharma will become manifest like pointing to the palm of your hand. This, the power of your vows. Earlier in this book, he talks about the importance of vows. In particular, the four bodhisattva vows that we do at least a couple times a day. Here he says, just reverting to an earlier part of the text, the practice of the four vows first makes liberation of others the number one pledge, along with clarifying your own nature, cutting off the root of afflictions, studying all teachings, and carrying out the activities of bodhisattvas, so compassion and wisdom are completely fulfilled. This is called the way of Buddhas. You should realize that great compassion is the foundation for actual attainment of Buddhahood. This is when one's practice can go into turbocharge, when we stop, we go beyond grasping for awakening for our own sake, and we realize that this is the most important thing we can possibly do for others. This is the greatest gift we can give to the world, this world that is in such horrendous shape. The greatest thing we can do, the greatest way we can help, is to come to awakening. Again, he says, you should realize that great compassion is the foundation for actual attainment of Buddhahood. Observe all people thoroughly, how they ignore basics and pursue trivia, greedily fixated on avaricious occupations, dying here and born there, compulsively repeating all sorts of futile routines. Who is entirely free of that? Furthermore, all living beings are your parents and siblings over lifetimes and generations, to whom your gratitude and love ought to be as toward your present parents and siblings. Considering this, you certainly must develop an attitude of great compassion. This is something you run across a lot in Tibetan Buddhism, that every being, certainly everyone we encounter and all beings, were once our parents or siblings in past lives. It's a way of eliciting this heart of compassion. And who knows but that it might be true? Who knows? If we act as though all beings have been our parents and siblings, how could that not be good for the world? Still staying here with vows. He says, when you have developed a resolute mind in this way, you can make great vows, vowing never to give up until you attain penetrating insight into essential nature, vowing to remain sunk forever rather than entertain a single thought of retreat, vowing to go to hell rather than be deluded by popular teachings, and rather than accept visionary states and thus fall into the views of the two vehicles or of outsiders. Vowing to carry out the acts of bodhisattvas forever once insight into essential nature is penetrating. Vowing not to give up without understanding each and every one of the verbal teachings of the Buddhas and masters. Vowing not to give up without penetrating progressive transcendence. Vowing not to give up without equaling the Buddhas and masters in power and application. Vowing not to develop a lowly mentality and disgrace the way of the school. Vowing not to be insincere and crave human sentiment. Vowing to produce one or two genuine successors to perpetuate the way of the school, to thank the Buddhas and masters, to practice the acts of bodhisattvas lifetime after lifetime, generation to generation, ultimately to liberate all living beings. When you have made great vows like this and made the vows of all Buddhas your own vows, made the will and conduct of the Zen masters your own will and conduct. General vows and particular vows may be activated at will. Just as the atmosphere sustains the earth, the atmosphere of great vows sustains Buddhahood. Just as a favorable wind drives a boat for the ocean of the essence of reality, there is the boat of insight, which cannot move but for the wind of wisdom from great vows. Those of you who tarry along the way in the mentalities of the three vehicles, the reasons you cannot plumb the profound wellspring of the Buddhas and Masters is that the strength of your vows is inadequate. All the more reason then when we take the four vows, for example, the four bodhisattva vows, to do it with our whole mind, to press the palms together. This will enable us to be more fully concentrated and resolute in these vows. Press the palms together in doing this with our whole mind. I'll go back to this part we left off. He says, just let go of gain and loss and affirmation and negation all at once and examine directly right where you are. When sitting, examine while sitting. Instead of examine, we could say, look into the koan. When active, examine while active. When lying down, examine while lying down. When eating, examine while eating. When speaking, examine while speaking. When doing all tasks, examine while doing all tasks. Again, the same emphasis as his teacher, Hakuin, and the other great masters, the importance of maintaining this practice in daily life. Zen practice is so much more than sitting. And our very best shot at maintaining this practice and activity is here in Sesshin, during the break periods, at meals, during work. I remember so often getting discouraged. I would come out of the Zendo and be so determined to keep my mind on Mu. And in no time, I'd catch the mind having wandered somewhere. And I would make the mistake, at first, of letting this derail me. Thinking, oh, great, you, after all of this, you promised yourself you would stay with it through this break period, and then now, already, it doesn't matter, you just go back to it. Don't lapse into that kind of inner dialogue. Just go back to Mu. Just pick it up again. And then if you slip off it 3 seconds later, pick it up again. He continues, suppose a precious jewel you had hidden away at home got lost one day and you didn't know where it was. When you search high and low and still can't find it, you're uneasy in mind. 24 hours a day, no matter what you're doing, you surreptitiously keep looking far and near. Whose business is this? And what is Buddha nature like? Who is the you that it is like? And he says, although in terms of the vows, although incapable of upholding them at first, eventually they'll succeed. Even if temporarily discouraged by obstruction caused by ingrained habits, if you can keep your vows in mind, you will return to your original mind before long. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.